This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. This summer, as the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was looming, we heard on the program from Shabana Basij Rasook. She's the co-founder of that country's only boarding school for girls, the School of Leadership Afghanistan, SOLA. And when we spoke to her in July, she was certainly concerned, but also determined.
I spoke with another woman who said, I see this coming. It's likely that Taliban could disrupt life temporarily here in Kabul, but we're not going to go back to that time. We're going to fight them.
But we know what happened after that. The Taliban swept into Kabul far faster than anyone had expected, and despite some lip service to preserving rights for women, the Taliban in power remains hard-line, to say the least. They've blocked women from holding government jobs and banned girls from attending secondary school. As the Taliban were seizing control, Shabana worked desperately to evacuate the students and staff of SOLA. Sue Halpern, who's a staff writer, had been trying to keep in touch with her, and last week, she was finally able to get the full story.
Over the summer, as the news was coming in from Afghanistan, I was concerned for Shabana and her students because I knew they'd be an obvious target for violence. Shabana had already lived under the Taliban as a child. And when we talked back in July, she told me how she had to dress as a boy to attend school in secret.
I remember my father saying this to us quite repeatedly at that time, that everything we have could be taken away from us. But he would say that if there is one thing that no one, and I mean no one, can take away from us, that is our education, our ability to think for ourselves. 20 years ago, statistically, I didn't exist. There were zero female students in Afghanistan 20 years ago. But look at me today. I am not only a highly educated Afghan woman, I run a school where girls from 28 of the 34 provinces come to SOLA, most often because they don't have the opportunity to continue with their education where they live.
When the provinces began to fall, I reached out to Shabana, who told me she was working around the clock on a plan. In fact, she'd been working on that plan since the Trump administration struck a deal with the Taliban back in February 2020. Then this past April, President Biden announced a unilateral withdrawal from Afghanistan, and those plans accelerated.
That is really when things got real. It's safe to say there was a beginning of countless sleepless nights. I tried as much as I could to find out what was really happening. But what was becoming clear day by day was that operating SOLA as the first and only boarding school for girls in Afghanistan, as usual, was increasingly becoming irresponsible. We looked at all sorts of possibilities. We looked at many, many contingency plans. And finally, what made most sense was doing a study abroad year. What's interesting is that I was looking at countries in the region, but where I made the most progress in the shortest period of time was a country that I had never imagined taking my students to, and that was Rwanda. And so in the beginning of August, I took a two-day trip to Rwanda. On my way back to Afghanistan, I received a text message from the president's office informing me that the plan is approved and that we could move forward with our study abroad program in Rwanda. There are many more details that I can't talk about, but what happened in the very, very last moment was our carefully planned study abroad program turned into an evacuation.
There's a lot Shabana can't talk about in order to protect the many people who helped her get the entire school, including the staff and their families, out of the country in the midst of the chaos. But the other reason is that it was a traumatic experience that's too raw to recount in detail. As Kabul fell, I tried to track what was happening with Shabana and Sola as best as I could, and at one point saw a horrifying image she shared on Twitter of a fire consuming all the school records of her students to keep the documents from falling into the hands of the Taliban.
There was an Afghan father who saw all of this coming way before anyone did. And this was December 2019. He came from a village in a province in Afghanistan where there were no schools for girls, and his daughter was the only educated girl in his village, and she was studying at SOLA. And he came to see me because he wanted to convince me to admit his other daughter, who was 8 years old. And I was trying to help him understand that she was too young to join us as a sixth grader. He got up, he said goodbye, and he was almost out of my office, and he turned around and he said, "And oh, by the way," and he didn't even say "if." He said, when the Taliban come, I want you to promise me that you will burn any and all records indicating that my daughter was ever a student at your school." And I think I said something along the lines of course, I don't see that ever happening. Let's hope that never happens. But if it does, you have my promise. You have my word. I couldn't stop thinking about him and what he had told me. And at this point, I knew that the families of our students could be harassed and targeted if any information links them back to SOLA.
Kabul fell on August 15th. On August 20th, I got a message that Shabana had somehow managed to get 250 people out of Afghanistan, and 100 of them were young girls. This was a time when getting a single person through the gauntlet of checkpoints and Taliban fighters and the pandemonium at the airport seemed nearly impossible. And of course, I wanted to know how she did it.
I unfortunately can't share too many details, but what I can say, and some of it simply because it's in a way too painful to relive some of these moments. What I can say is that the one decision that I made that ended up being key to the success of our plan was I had a commercial flight on August 14th that I did not take. I knew that if I left, there would be no way anyone from our community, any of our students, would be able to make it to Rwanda. So what I can say is that I feel indebted to the government of Rwanda, to the government of Qatar, and to many, many individuals at the U.S. State Department for working around the clock to help me make all of this happen.
So, okay, so you were working around the clock, but you have 100 girls in your school. They were already kind of planning on leaving the country, so that was already in motion. But What was the mood at SOLA, and what was going on with the girls? And how are you handling what had to be a fairly traumatic time in their lives?
Everyone truly believed. We all believed that this was going to be a study abroad program. The girls each got to pack a suitcase, and they all had their SOLA laptops with them. And the conversation was, can I bring this? Can I bring this item with me? Or, but obviously at the end, no one could bring anything they packed. They only came to the airport with a backpack or a purse, nothing more.
And why did they have to leave their stuff behind? Why did they have to just limit it to a backpack?
There were all sorts of rumors that, you know, even within city, movement within city, getting from any point in the city to the airport, if you had anything with you indicating that you were headed to the airport, could be risky. So a lot of people just walked to the airport or took a taxi to a point and then got off and walked. And then you couldn't have any indication that you belonged to a group getting out, you know, and certainly that was the case with our students and our colleagues. I at one point ended up at the airport with my phone and my passport and nothing else on me. I didn't even have a charger. I have borrowed power bank from many, many U.S. Army soldiers and State Department reps who were at the airport to keep my phone charging. The focus was the immediate, what was in front of me. Students and colleagues stuck at Taliban checkpoints and constantly trying to assure them they're okay and they are going to be okay when at a time when I didn't even know. Quite frankly, we didn't know if we would be able to, if everyone would be able to make it out. It's actually something, look at us, we're all out. Every single person who wanted to come with us made it out. And it is that thought still haunts me. It suddenly takes over all my senses in a way. It's just this idea of what if we lost a student? And I have to work very, very hard to remind myself that this is in my head, that physically everyone is out. We're fine. We're really fine. I obviously was incredibly relieved when our last group made it through, but there wasn't a sense of victory or win. In the days that I was stuck at the airport and was traveling in between checkpoints around the clock, I witnessed something that pains me to my core.
It's okay. You don't have to say what you don't want to say.
I think it's important that I finish what I wanted to say. And watching people even beyond the solar community, watching thousands and thousands of Afghans forced out of their homes, forced out of the livelihood that they made for themselves, was very painful. Watching brain draining from Afghanistan was very painful. Give me a second, please.
Sure. It's unclear when the girls are going to be able to see their families again, but for now, they're safe and in school.
And we ended up in Rwanda. We're in a place where people truly understand what it means to lose your home. People are very kind. A lot of Rwandans that I have spoken with, they all remind us how they were once forced out of their homes, how they were once refugees themselves. And here they are, they have returned. So Rwanda is an inspiration for us. Rwanda is a reminder that being in exile isn't the end. Our campus in Rwanda is it's a beautiful Afghan community.
Tell us as much as you can about where you see SOLA going in the future.
We will not in any way allow Taliban to win. Girls under the Taliban regime are not allowed to go to secondary school right now, making Afghanistan the only country on earth where girls' access to secondary school is outlawed. For me, SOLA and educating Afghan girls was never, ever about a job. For me, it's my life's work and it's my way of life. For as long as there is an Afghanistan, for as long as there is an Afghan girl, for me, this work continues. SOLA's mission was, is, and always will be to educate Afghan girls. And no one can get in the way of that. Don't look away. Don't look away from Afghanistan. Don't look away from Afghan girls and Afghan women. The last time the U.S. and the rest of the world chose to look away from Afghanistan, it was devastating both for Afghanistan and the U.S. We cannot afford for any of that to happen again.
Shabana Basij Rasuk. She spoke with Sue Halpern, who's a staff writer. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, and this week on our podcast, Politics and More, Dexter Filkins joins us to talk about the life and career of General Colin Powell in all its complexity and all its bitter irony.
In the hours and days after 9/11, began this conversation inside the Bush administration about striking Iraq. And I think it's fair to say Powell was acutely aware of that obsession, and he pushed back against it. I think ultimately he lost and was ultimately used. There's a great line, and I think it's in Powell's memoirs, where Cheney says to him in the run-up to the Iraq War, look, you're the most popular man in America. Use that popularity for something, which he did. And so the enduring image from that moment, that incredible moment where he gives this, long presentation, it's like more than an hour long, it's like 78 minutes, where he holds up the little vial of white powder and says, this could be anthrax, we could be attacked with anthrax because, Sudan has the capability of making this. Powell took this enormous popularity and credibility he had in front of the American people and kind of put it all on the line.
When you were listening to that speech, what did you think?
I remember listening to that speech, and it's Colin Powell. I felt as an American citizen, I felt reassured. I felt like that's a guy you can trust. Colin Powell was such a kind of an extraordinary American figure that, he gave an amazing presentation, and it was convincing, and he's convincing, and it was all of his credibility, and that's why this story it's a tragedy on both levels. Turned out to be a tragedy for the United States and for the Middle East, and kind of this hideously executed war. That turned out to be unnecessary, but also a personal tragedy for Powell, because it's in the first paragraph of his obit.
That's Dexter Filkins on Politics and More, hosted by Dorothy Wickenden. You can find it along with the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you listen to podcasts. Andy Borowitz is one of our great humorists. He writes the Borowitz Report for The New Yorker, which is a satirical news column. But Andy wasn't kidding at all when he said he wanted to interview Jane Goodall at the New Yorker Festival. He calls Goodall one of his real childhood heroes, and she's certainly a revered figure in modern science. Goodall began her study of chimpanzees in 1960, working with the scientist Louis Leakey. And what she observed in the field completely changed our understanding of how primates behave, including humans. Goodall has just published The Book of Hope, a survival guide for trying times. Goodall used to travel as much as 300 days of the year, but since the pandemic, she's been at her home in England, in the house where she grew up. and her conversation with Andy Borowitz was recorded for this year's edition of the New Yorker Festival.
Welcome, Dr. Jane Goodall, to the New Yorker Festival. It is my honor.
Well, thanks very much. And I think it's going to be great talking with you. I can tell. Even though we're separated and Zooming, I can still feel people's personalities.
Well, I know that you have pretty good instincts when it comes to primates, which I am. So I'm going to have to go with that. I have to believe that. So much to cover. We're just going to jump right in. Tell us a little bit about the stuffed animal that you received when you were around 1 year old.
Well, that was Jubilee. It was to commemorate the first chimpanzee born in London Zoo, named Jubilee because it was the Jubilee of the King and Queen at that time. And Jubilee's been with me ever since. But unfortunately, he's now in this exhibition called Becoming Jane. And Jubilee, you know, he's like 84, 85. He's in a bulletproof glass case. That was the only way I'd let him leave me.
The house you grew up in is in Bournemouth, which is the south coast of England. It's called the Birches.
Yep.
I understand you spent a lot of your childhood up a tree. Is that the case?
That's correct. It's a beech tree. And Beech, I called him Beech. He's still out there in the garden. And I love Beech so much. I used to take my homework up there. I used to read Dr. Doolittle, Tarzan up there. And so I think I was 10 years old when I wrote out what I thought a last will and testament would look like. And I got my grandmother to sign Beech to me after she died.
Well, you went to school. You graduated at the age of 18. And there was no money to send you to university. So what was your next move?
Well, I had to get some money. We had very little money. And so Mum scraped up enough for a secretarial course in London. And I got a job in London. But, of course, that was just always marking time. Then came the opportunity I'd been waiting for, invitation to have a holiday in Kenya, issued by a school friend of mine. And I had to come home to save up enough money for the fare. You couldn't save in London. And finally had enough money to buy a return ticket to Kenya.
Now, you were brought up, it seems, by two very, very strong and loving women, your mother and your grandmother. Can you tell me something about them and what they, the gifts that they gave you?
Well, I was really lucky. I mean, I was born loving animals. Just people say, what triggered your love? I don't know. I mean, I was born that way. And I was lucky enough to have a really supportive mother. So she didn't get mad when she found earthworms in bed with me. So she said, Jane, you were looking so intently as though you were wondering, how do they walk without legs? I was 1.5. I don't remember that. If I'd had a different kind of mother, that scientific curiosity might have been crushed, and I might not have done what I've done.
What about your grandmother?
Well, my grandmother was Danny. She was one of those women who was one of the first to actually get a job as a young woman. She got a job teaching physical training to young ladies at a school. And she was just, I don't know what there was about Danny, but she was quite stern, but she had a heart of gold. And her husband died. I never met my grandfather, which I'm very sad about. But when she died, she had all his letters tied up with red ribbon on her chest when Mum went in the morning. Mm. And she said, please send these with me on my long journey. It was very moving.
Yes. So we've taken you to your first voyage to Africa, and there you meet the person who would really send your life in a whole new direction, Louis Leakey. Can you tell us about your first meeting with him and your first impressions of him?
Somebody said, well, if you're interested in animals, you should meet Louis. Well, first of all, I called, and Leakey hated the telephone. So a very grumpy voice said, I'm Leakey, what do you want? Which was a bit off-putting as I was very shy. But anyway, I was so keen to go and see somebody who might tell me something about animals that I went. I could answer the questions he was asking me. And I think that impressed him. And so, you know, that boring old secretarial work that, you know, the course that I'd done, 2 days before I met Leakey, his secretary had suddenly, unexpectedly quit, and he needed a secretary. And so there I was. So it was magical.
He obviously saw your potential, and he was not only willing to overlook the fact that you didn't have university training, he saw that as something of an asset, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He didn't tell me at the time, but he, you know, the very early animal behavior people were very reductionist in their thinking. I mean, they thought there was a difference between us and all other animals, a difference of kind. We were absolutely unique up on this pedestal, and there was an unbridgeable chasm between us and other animals. And I shouldn't talk about animals having personalities, minds capable of solving problems, and certainly not emotions, because those were unique to us. But I didn't know that at the time. I hadn't been to college. But Leakey sort of knew a bit about that. And so he was very happy to have somebody who hadn't been brainwashed. My childhood companion, my teacher, my dog, had taught me that what the professors were saying when I got to Cambridge was rubbish. But anyway, so that was an advantage in Leakey's eyes. Also, the fact that I was a woman. He felt women might be more patient in the field.
You like to talk about yourself as a naturalist as opposed to a scientist. What's the difference?
Well, the difference to me is that science is very factual oriented. And that's good. I'm not saying there's anything against that. But what's missing in so many ethological scientists is this sense of wonder and awe and not wanting everything to be explained, because some things never can be explained. I'm pretty sure about that.
So what was Leakey's specific goal for you? He got a few months of funding to send you out to Gombe to look at these chimps, which hadn't really been observed before. When he sent you off with your provisions and your African cook, Dominic, what was your mission statement?
Okay, well, he never really told me too much at the time. But in fact, you know, he was a paleoanthropologist, and he'd spent his life searching for the fossils of Stone Age people in Africa. And of course, from a fossil, you can tell an awful lot from the muscle attachment. Did the creature, how did it walk? And from tooth wear, what sort of food did it eat? But behavior doesn't fossilize. So because chimps are our closest relative, and back then we didn't even know how close they were. We didn't know that the DNA of humans and chimps differs by only just over 1%. So he postulated, now accepted, but then it was a bit far out, that about 6 million years ago, there was an ape-like, human-like creature, a common ancestor. And so he reasoned, if Jane sees behavior in chimpanzees today that's the same or similar to human behavior today, maybe that behavior was already in the common ancestor, and we brought it with us on our separate evolutionary pathways, things like kissing, embracing, holding hands, patting one another, swaggering, males competing for dominance. And he felt this would give him a better feeling for how early humans might have behaved.
Well, to accomplish that mission, you first had to get a chimp to not run away from you, which was a problem in the early months.
Yeah, it was the early observations were all through binoculars and, you know, from a reasonable distance. And I was getting really worried because it was money for 6 months. And I knew if I didn't see sort of exciting things before the money ran out, that would be the end of the dream. And worse, in a way, I would have let Leakey down because he really stuck his neck out.
Mm.
Jane Goodall, the primate scientist and UN messenger of peace, in conversation with Andy Borowitz at the New Yorker Festival. They'll continue in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm David Remnick, and we're listening today to an interview with Jane Goodall recorded as part of this year's New Yorker Festival. After so many years of studying primate behavior, Goodall became a major figure in conservation through the Jane Goodall Institute. Goodall has written many books. Some are about her fieldwork with chimps, while others concern us, human beings, and our role on the earth. Her latest is called The Book of Hope, a survival guide for trying times. Goodall spoke with Andy Borowitz for the New Yorker Festival, and they went back to her first fieldwork with chimpanzees more than 60 years ago in Gombe Stream National Park.
I think you know that right at the beginning, what's Tanzania today was back then Tanganyika. It was part of the crumbling British colonial empire. And the authorities just weren't prepared to take responsibility for this young girl going into potential danger. But in the end, they said, oh, well, all right, she can come, but she has to have a companion. So it was my amazing mother who volunteered to come for the first 4 months. And it was amazing because I'd get back in the evening, depressed, had chimps had run away again. And she was boosting my morale, telling me, well, you know, you're seeing more than you think. You found this peak, and with your binoculars, you know how the chimps move around in different size groups, sometimes alone. You know about their calls they make. You know about the kind of foods they're eating and how they make nests at night in the trees, bending over the branches.
So you, in your new book, you make a dedication to a primate named David Graybeard, who I guess, along with Louis Leakey, was one of the most important primates in your life.
Well, David contributed in many ways. First of all, by letting me get close to him. But the real breakthrough was seeing David using and making tools, grass stems to fish termites from their underground burrows, nests, and picking leafy twigs and to use them as tools, carefully picking off the leaves and side twigs. So, you know, at the time it was thought humans and only humans used and made tools. And that was what enabled Leakey to go to the Geographic. They agreed that they fund the research when that 6 months money ran out. And they sent a filmmaker, Hugo van Lawick, who was able to document the behavior that I was gradually learning more and more about as the other chimps came to accept me as well.
Could you talk about a couple of the mother chimps and what you learned from them? Specifically, Flo seemed like a very important character as you were studying the parenting behavior of chimp moms.
Flo was amazing. She was the matriarch. She was the highest ranking female. She already had two offspring when I first knew her. No, three. And so I was able to watch when she had the next baby. And the key thing we now know, we can look back through 60 years of observations. A good mother is supportive, just like my mother. The good mothers who are willing to run in and risk being attacked, to protect their child. And it now seems quite clear that the offspring of these supportive mothers do best. The males get to a higher position in the hierarchy, probably sire more kids, and the females are better mothers. So we can contrast Flo with Passion, who was a rather cold mother. She seldom supported her offspring. She wasn't really a very nice female at all. She was also high ranking, but her children never did anything much compared to Flo, whose sons, one after the other, became alpha male.
When you had your son, how much were you looking to a chimp like Flo for mothering tips?
Well, you know, I had my own mother as well. And and also at that time, the popular book for people was Dr. Spock. So it was a kind of mixture of Flo, Mum, and Dr. Spock. But what I really got from the chimps were two important things. One, they had fun with their infants. They played with them. They laughed. And I thought, I'm going to have fun with my baby too. And the other thing was the tremendous importance of support in the first couple of years, which is really important for our children too. So to have a little group, two or three supportive adults who are always there, continuity for the child, who give that child confidence. And the final thing, if a chimp infant is irritating, like a mother's termite fishing, and the infant is grabbing onto her grass tools, and she's very irritated, but she doesn't punish the child, not till he's learned that he mustn't do it. She will distract. So with one hand, she's tool-using. With the other hand, she's tickling her infant. And so I thought, well, that's important for me too.
So you returned to Cambridge to get your PhD in ethology. What kind of culture clash was that? I mean, you had been in Africa up close with the chimps, but you went back to Cambridge and had to deal with this whole other group of people, academics. How did they greet your findings?
They did not like the fact that I'd named the chimps and that I talked about all these different personalities. And so I dealt with it in the way I deal with these things. I knew they were wrong. I just quietly went on writing the way I thought I should write. And of course, it wasn't nice being mixed up with lots of people. I love being alone and being out in the rainforest. So I managed, I had a lovely tutor, and she helped me. And together we explained, well, you know, Jane's been on her own in the forest, and it really makes her tense and kind of, you know, psychologically upset if she's with a lot of people, which wasn't true. But we got permission for me to go outside into the country.
Well, that brings me to the Book of Hope. And now I like the way you define hope in the book, because as you define hope, it's not just blind faith or optimism. It's tied to action. So you say to your co-author in the book, you have a wonderful line where you say, I hope that this book is good, but it won't be unless we work really hard at it. And that's kind of the template for your approach to life. Yeah, it's good to be optimistic, but let's actually get down and get to work.
Yep. Because if you don't have hope, then why bother to do anything? If you don't think that what you do is going to make a difference, why bother to do it? Why not just sit back, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die? And if we don't get together and take action, then, oh, I think our race, our species is doomed. The window of time isn't that big. And when we started on this book, Doug said, well, you're talking too much about the doom and the gloom. This is meant to be hope. I said, yes, but if you don't acknowledge the terrible things that we're doing to the planet and to each other, then people will say, oh, well, she's just looking at the world through rose-tinted spectacles. That's not true. I know as much as anyone about all the harm we've inflicted, but there is still a window of time. And if we get together and realize that each one of us makes an impact every day, it's not too late.
I'd like to do a quick rundown of your four main reasons for hope in the book, if you're game for that.
Sure.
The first reason I love, which is you say, you cite as reason number one, the amazing human intellect. Tell us what you think our intellect can do to get us out of this mess.
Okay, well, the reason I use intellect rather than intelligence, the thing that makes us more different from chimps and everything else is the explosive development of our intellect. I mean, you know, animals are way, way, way more intelligent than people used to think, but, you know, we've designed a rocket that went up to Mars and took photos. It's still there. So how bizarre that this most intellectual creature is destroying its only home. But now scientists are beginning to come up with all sorts of innovative technology to help heal some of the harm that we've inflicted, like moving towards renewable energy as one example. And people in their individual lives are beginning to think about, you know, how you behave and what you buy and did it harm the environment? Was it cruel to animals? Is it cheap because of unfair wages or forced labor? And if so, don't buy it. So, you know, we're really beginning to use our brains to leave lighter ecological footprints.
Another reason out of the four reasons for hope that you state, another reason is the resilience of nature, which is something we don't think about very often. But tell me what you mean by that. How does nature show its resilience despite all our depredations?
Well, these are the stories that more people in the media should tell to give people hope. Like at one time around Gombe, the trees had virtually gone, so what was once forest was bare hills with more people than the land could support. And that's when it hit me. If we don't help these people living in poverty to find ways of making a living without destroying the environment, we haven't a hope of saving chimps, forests, or anything else. And so we began our program, Take Care, or TACARI, it's known as. So it's, you know, restoring fertility to the overused land and so on. The trees have come back, and this is operating throughout chimp range in Tanzania and in six other African countries.
You have this great program called Roots and Shoots. What is it about young people that gives you a reason for hope?
It was in the late 80s when I was traveling around the world that I kept meeting young people who seemed to have lost hope. And mostly they were just apathetic, didn't seem to care. Some were really depressed, some were angry. So I talked to them. Well, you've compromised our future and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, we have compromised their future. We've been stealing it for years and years and years. And so I started Roots and Shoots, which I think the reason it's growing so fast, it's in more than 65 countries. But we don't dictate to the young people. They choose between them as a group, a project to help people, a project to help animals, a project to help the environment, because everything's interrelated. And the main message is every single one of us makes an impact on the planet every single day, and we can choose what sort of impact we make, which leads into the fact that we've got to alleviate poverty, because if you're really poor, you're going to destroy the environment to get land to grow food to feed your family or buy cheap junk food. You can't afford to ask, did it harm the environment? But, you know, these young people, once you listen to them, educate them and empower them, they talk about what they care about. They roll up their sleeves and they get out there and they take action.
Okay, reason number four is what you call the indomitable human spirit. You are certainly an embodiment of that. You are indomitable. Just out of curiosity, where does your energy come from? What pushes you forward?
Well, first of all, I care. I'm very passionate. Secondly, I'm probably obstinate and pretty resilient. So knock me over and I'm going to bounce back up because I will not be defeated. And so, you know, as I get older, I'm nearly 88 now. I've got less time left. So I have to do more and more and more because there's so much to do.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. So would you indulge me and let me ask you a few questions that my readers posted on Facebook?
Yep.
Okay, question number one. What are a couple of things that the average person can do to stop climate change?
Well, one really important thing is moving towards a plant-based diet, because these factory farms, not only horribly cruel with billions of animals, but they all have to be fed. So huge areas of environment are destroyed to grow the grain, masses of fossil fuel to get the grain to the animals, to the abattoir, meat to the table. Water uses lots of water to change vegetable to animal protein, and water is getting increasingly scarce in many parts of the world.
Well, I have a question. This is sort of a personal question, but a kind of minor but significant character in the Book of Hope is whiskey. How did your acquaintanceship with whiskey begin, and what is your favorite whiskey?
I don't like the very expensive, malty, peaty whiskeys. I don't like them. But it began because my mother, she couldn't drink wine. She couldn't drink gin. She could drink whiskey. And so every evening when I was here, we used to have a little tot at 7 o'clock for supper. And so when I was traveling, we kept this up at 7 o'clock in the time where we were. We raised a glass to each other of whiskey.
Third question came up from a lot of people. They want to know what you think about bonobos.
Well, they are equally closely related to us as chimps. I'm very glad Leakey didn't choose bonobos for me to study, because the females are permanently sexually receptive and they have big pink swellings on their backside, and the Geographic would never at that time have wanted photographs. There's no question. You know, one of the early pictures that Hugo took came back, and it was four males sitting, and they were all a bit excited. So they all had penile erections, and the Graphic yes. came back with a circle around each one saying, blend into fur.
Jane, I want to personally thank you so much. This is actually a conversation I've waited my entire life to have. So I just want to send you my gratitude and my love.
Well, thank you too. And, you know, it's been really lovely talking to you. And I hope that when I'm next over your side of the Atlantic, we can meet in person and share a whiskey.
Thanks, Jane. I will hold you to that.
Jane Goodall and Andy Borowitz. Goodall's new work is called The Book of Hope. We'll be bringing you more highlights from this year's New Yorker Festival throughout the fall. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of TuneYards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help this week from Harrison Keithline, Joe Plord, Amy Pearl, and Allison McAdam.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.